Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guest is Phil Wood, a people partner at Swoon Editions.
HR, it's been a pretty set system for a long time, and I think systematically it tends to be quite difficult. There's not that much room there to kind of disrupt, but there has to be other approaches that you can look at and think that can be improved. We can approach things differently. You know, I don't like the way that this is assumed that we need to handle these problems in this kind of way. You know, what areas, I suppose, you know, aside from kind of your ideas of what you'd like to see change or potentially disrupted, you know, what have you kind of seen that's already happened within kind of your expertise over the last number of years that you think is making a shift? And, you know, does technology necessarily play a role in that?
You're right. I mean, disruption, it seems to be the very fashionable word at the moment in terms of, you know, new businesses that are trying to unsettle the marketplace. From obviously most of my background is in the resourcing space. And, you know, if I think about the journey that I've been through where it was, you know, personal networks and posting adverts out and trying to attract on the basis of that through to now where we've got so many different businesses and talent partners that are trying to augment the technology place that we currently have, in terms of looking for every stage of that from building talent pipelines through to attraction, through to assessment and onboarding. You know, you could probably work with, you know, 7 to 8 different partners, you know, potentially dozens of different partners, different stages of the process. Whereas historically you've put in your ATS and that's kind of done you happy. The area that I think is really interesting isn't about that talent identification, actually having people think more so about what they want in their business. So I've been speaking with companies like the likes of Chemistry Recruitment. I don't know if you've ever spoken with Roger Philby or those guys over there, or Chris Platts and Talent Rocket, who've got a product called ThriveMap, which are fascinating ways of looking at how you assess potential candidates beyond using the experience that's on their CV or necessarily their qualifications to see whether they're actually going to be the right fit for that organization.
When I think about kind of disruption, the one thing that I have particularly inherent interest in seeing disrupted is kind of education, and mainly the university and higher. What was your experiences like when you were being taught, quote unquote, the kind of principles and way to approach things when you started off and were being trained? How different is that aspect to the reality of your role?
So I've seen it in different guises in different organizations. So my very first role, obviously education is vitally important when you're recruiting for graduate level roles, as it's, you know, indicative of potentially, hopefully, how that person's likely to perform or whether they're going to have the base level intellect that's necessary for the role. It's not the be all and end all, though. I think it's a really easy thing for people to use as a yes no pass to say whether you've got A, B, C, D, E education, but it shouldn't be for businesses that are looking for the best talent. It shouldn't be a limiting factor. Just trying to think back through my career, I mean, but worked in publishing where education was very important because it was in a semi-academical environment. And, you know, if you're talking to lawyers and you're talking to individuals of that nature, you have to be able to hold that conversation and intellect was one of the things that they related back to that. So on the basis of that, academics was essential. Moving into transport, actually academics, not the be-all and end-all. It's really not. It's the drivers, it's the motivations, it's the things that, it's the behaviours that the person is going to bring to the role that's actually going to want to add, you know, add the best value. Then moving again into construction, a lot of construction, depending on the nature of the role of the engineers and as such, they have to have gone through specific qualifications. They've got to probably be chartered engineers. They've gone through probably a 4 years master's course. So those things have to be set in stone where it's essential for the role. But where it's non-essential, I think there's got to be something that we can be looking at or a way we can be assessing people that adds more value than just did they go to a Red Brick or a Russell Group uni or something like that.
It's like a two-pronged approach, isn't it? Because you have, I think there's obviously a problem on the educational side, institutional level. I think that needs to be kind of disrupted. I don't think that necessarily just because you have a degree in a certain from a certain school necessarily means that you're qualified for anything. You know, I look at internship programs and these kind of things, and my experiences from people I've spoken to who've been involved in internship programs is that it's less about kind of their development, and it seems like it's more about like a do-gooding thing from the corporation. So the skills that they're actually learning on these like apprenticeships or internships still don't necessarily like serve the purpose. They're not preparing. It's kind of the work is tends to be kind of irrelevant.
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously a risk, I think, you know, whenever you're kind of getting people hands-on involved in things early on. But, like, I think that we don't have enough faith in giving people responsibilities at a younger age. And I think that that doesn't necessarily make any sense. So, yeah, I think there is a responsibility on the organizational side, on how we're onboarding people, you know, young people. But, you know, there's also a massive problem in education and the skills that we're actually learning.
Well, I think there's quite a disconnect between industry and the education system, where we're producing people, producing young people that are undoubtedly talented, undoubtedly intelligent, but don't necessarily, you know, on the whole, like I know when I was an 18-year-old kid, I had no idea what I wanted to do. We're then asking these guys to go on internships or come into apprenticeship schemes, which could define their career. But they're not a position where they necessarily want their career defined. I mean, I interviewed a load of interns a few years back, and every single one of them, it was for a HR internship. They didn't know what HR was. They didn't know what they wanted to do, whether that was the career they wanted in the longer term. And yeah, we could sell it to them. We could explain the role. We could explain everything they're going to be doing. And they're happy to try it. If that's what they want for the rest of their life, there's got to be more engagement from businesses, I think, into, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16 year olds to understand what they want to in order to produce the best talent. I mean, one of my last jobs was with High Speed 2. And obviously the skills gaps for engineers, is huge, as was well noted. So obviously they've gone about establishing an HS2 academy in school. In order to produce, but that's not going to be producing talent for HS2 necessarily. That's going to be producing talent for the entire sector, which will hopefully massively uplift, you know, where we can take the construction industry in the future. But you don't see, you know, technology companies necessarily thinking the same. You don't see other organizations thinking that's potentially a viable way forward to produce the best people for them.
Well, why though? I don't, you know. Why is that? Why are they not thinking in these ways? I mean, surely now, especially in technology, like retention is particularly difficult, right? So if you breed and put the resources into people early down the road, you see that inherent ROI because they're motivated to stay. Is that right? Or I don't know.
You'd think so. I mean, obviously not every organization has got the ability to build its own academy just from a pure financial perspective. You know, so there's that focus. I suppose because it is a long-term ROI, startups aren't necessarily going to think it's, you know, where they're thinking about the next 6 to 12 months, they're not going to be able to have that level of investment into their future. But maybe that's the wrong way about it. I don't know. I mean, obviously, we've got the apprenticeship piece, and well, I can't think of the right name for it now, a week out of work and my brain's fried, the levy that's coming in, where obviously organisations have to bring in more young people or potentially pay a fine. You know, what's that money going to go towards? How can we potentially refocus that on preparing young people for the workplace, or promoting more interaction between local businesses of a certain size and local education systems?
It's it's an interesting one. I don't know what my approach is. I think the easy liberal standpoint is to point the finger at the larger organizations. It's like, yeah, startups don't have the resources to necessarily give them the experience they need to be a value add or to consider taking on something like that. But the big organizations certainly do. Yep. So maybe they're the ones we do need to point the finger at, kind of those kind of organizations that are so large, that maybe that's their way of giving back. Maybe instead of, you know, trying to hit them on the corporation tax, we say, right, well, if you make over whatever, you have to build, the fair apprenticeship scheme for people to get the experiences they need.
Or invest a certain amount of hours, almost like in a certain element of community spirit, or, you have to invest hours back into the local community if you're drawing resource from it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I agree. I think so. I think so. I think that that's, I certainly think that that's one idea that would make a lot of sense to do. I'm sure they'll find a way out of that as well. But not that I hate big corporation, but
no, not at all. But there's got to be some greater link between, like a gateway system for people to enter into the workplace where they can be in full knowledge of actually what it is they might be doing.
Well, it works in full circle as well, because then you get better skilled workers as well out of it in the community. So you don't have to go as far to find the talent that you need. So it comes full circle eventually. Like you say, it's just a longer ROI, which is the hard bit. Looking at retention, I kind of briefly mentioned it earlier, especially within tech now, we know it's a candidate market out there these days, especially for like technical roles. What's that been like as far on the retention side, and how much have HR had to change their strategy in order to really ensure that they're, motivating people to stay? Is there things you can do a lot of the time, or is it just kind of the fact that they're going to be motivated to go and you can't really stop that? Of course, it will be that sometimes, but, there must be different approaches now to kind of motivate people to stay.
I think you're right. I think there are. I mean, tech is always one of the higher areas of churn within most organisations, but I don't think there's one size fits all approach to it. I think you've got to have a human approach to each individual and see what their motivators are. If you've got somebody that's coming into the business to learn a new product and then wants to move on in 18 months, that's great. Get them in, learn what you can from them, but be aware that you've got 18 months with them and build in a succession plan. If you've got someone that's coming in and has, had a very disruptive career, they want to be on an exciting product, then you can attract and appeal to them in that manner. If you've got a product, a lot of people that I speak to in the tech space, they get thrown into the deep end. They're expected to do things at 100 miles an hour, and they very rarely get reinvestment back into them. So, the last organization that I worked with, we had a really good tech team. A lot of internal promotion. It wasn't the sexiest tech stack in the world. It was effectively websites that our guys were building with a few back-end products internally built, which was interesting. But by having the ability to build a real team spirit within the department, they're having pizza nights and hackathons within their own products to try and break things, just stuff that actually engaged them beyond their day job, actually I think really aided our retention. Because they could see the journey of where they were going, and having a very clear roadmap and how each individual played into that roadmap, I think gave them that personal investment.
It's interesting you say that, actually. I was talking about the other day, the way that people approach business and work, there seems to be like a behavior around kind of business and going to work that you have to kind of adapt to. And it's a totally different style than someone who would be social. And I think that's always going to be the case slightly. But I was saying the other day, I was like, well, you know, what if we all went to the office and everyone had a good time and had a laugh and socialized with each other? Why is that so frowned upon? You know, why are we like, they're work people, they're not friends?
My last CEO wrote an interesting piece on this. So company I used to work for has just taken 280-something people out to Ibiza for a long weekend. And it's exactly with that mindset, you know, if people are friends and people actually get on a personal level, when it comes to professional circumstances, they're going to have more respect for each other and they're going to work together more effectively. So actually the ROI of taking people out away for a long weekend where, they have parties, they go off and do different things. It's intangible to the relationships that are built.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. I think that it's some businesses, I think it's more of a natural thing to do that. But what, you know, why isn't that? Even if like you don't have necessarily the budget, you know, but you're a team leader, you don't have a social budget, like you still should be trying to round up troops to be like, let's do something, let's all get together and do something. You know, even if it's all together, like surely that is gonna help massively. And, you know, I would be surprised if HR aren't encouraging that more, but it doesn't seem to always happen.
I think HR business partners or managers should be working with the leaders of the team on, you know, multiple levels of kind of a strategy in terms of, you know, the corporate development. What does that look like? How do we take them into a roadmap, the drivers for the business? Then at the personal level, what does it look like for each individual? But also, how do you then bring a team together? So what's the strategy in terms of, like you say, going to the pub for a Friday night, going to do a charity event together, going and playing, you know, paintball or crazy golf or whatever it might be, just get people inside and outside of the work environment together in slightly different ways that they might not necessarily work on. You know, we had it where we had people that worked on their kind of product, so they might be a front-end dev, and they'd have a project that they'd be working alongside their other front-end devs. But then they'd be also working with everyone that worked on the B2B platform. So obviously being the front-end dev representative for the B2B platform. So they're working effectively horizontally and vertically. So they're building up a bit more relationships and more things that they can leverage.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And what about HR as their team? Is that, surely that's kind of more paramount that they behave in that kind of way, and that kind of, you know, has that kind of knock-on effect externally as well.
I wouldn't limit it to HR. I think it's got to be for the senior leadership of an organisation. It's got to be something that they live and breathe. You know, if you see your directors and your senior leaders going out and doing this and behaving in that manner, then it will roll through the business.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. They're the ones who really see it. I just was interested to see your take on, you know, how the importance of HR having that kind of personality as well. But
the HR and people team are basically the bastions of that culture. They should be the ones that should be exhibiting what it is and what it means.
Yeah, I agree. It's like this, it's like servant leadership, isn't it? If you're, you know, if you want the people to act in a certain way, then you have to kind of betray that, you know. I love that term, servant leadership, by the way. It's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that it's an interesting one. So you know, for you, in your kind of role, your experiences, you know, what are some characteristics that you feel kind of served you well and that you would say are probably necessary if you do want to career in kind of HR talent?
The first thing that has probably served me well is just being, I would like to think, relatively down to earth and able to talk to anyone, be that, you know, the MD of a company or the first graduate that's just walked through the door, and actually having a genuine conversation with them where they understand where you're coming from. They truly believe that you're listening to them and they're going to take action on that. That's one thing. The second thing, and probably the most important, is actually having a really high level of integrity. So working within an HR environment, if you say you're going to do something, you know, you're affecting people's lives. You've got to do it, and you've got to do it to the best of your ability. So they're probably the two things that I think have really aided me to get to where I am at this moment in time, and hopefully further on.
I agree. It is those kind of little those things that do speak volumes in the long run, aren't they? I think you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy, but isn't it? But I think people kind of miss that element to their approach to work life. And were you kind of influenced by people, or was it something that you just kind of learned with time to kind of?
I think I've always been relatively social, so speaking to people has never been too much of a problem. That's probably taught to me by my parents and friends and family at a young age. I think the integrity thing, and actually that if you say something that you're going to do it, was really, really driven into me by a colleague of mine at one of my first companies. He was a HR business partner at the time, a chap called Rob Jane, who is one of the senior directors now at, I think it's Yahoo. Rob was the first proper HR person that I really saw working as a HR business partner. And the way that he built his relationships across the business, because exactly that, when he said he was going to do something, or he said something was going to happen, he did it and it happened. And he made things move at a really rapid pace within the organization, which was, you know, something I really was impressed by at a young point in my career. As then I moved through various different organizations, when I was working with a chap called Dorian Webb at HS2, very, very similar thing. You know, he came in as a contractor to head up the recruitment function there. And the first thing he did was sit down and said, right, we're going to do this, and that's exactly what we've done.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Like, people who say something and actually do it, we're always impressed by. It's crazy, exactly, isn't it?
Exactly that. I mean, most recently I've been working with a brilliant, brilliant lady by the name of Ange Patico, who's the CPO at NVF. And that was exactly it. I mean, she came in and said, look, we're shooting for the stars, we're aiming for the stars, but it's important. It's the most important thing is that we deliver everything that we say. So you'd rather limit the projects we're going to work on, but massively over-deliver upon our expectations. So all of our our C-level guys knew we were being stretched, but it was realistic that we could deliver it. And funnily enough, we delivered on everything, and the team is moving on at an absolute rapid pace.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... It's not shooting low, is it? It's just realism. Yep. And I think people appreciate that. I think you have to dream big, and then it's incremental things that you deliver on is the approach to take. And
But it's also having the ability to say, yes, it is a vital piece of work. It is a very, very, you know, important and worthy project. But at the moment, we've got A, B, C, D, and E, which are actually more important. So we're going to put yours into Q2, Q3, whatever. And concentrate on these for the time being, but it's still there, and we will engage with you when we come to it, and you will help us deliver it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I like that a lot. I think I've always taken very seriously. I think it's just delivering on promises, and it will go a long way. And honesty as well. I think no matter how experienced you are, I tend to believe that people who get to a certain point in their career where they're experienced enough, they tend to stop asking for help or opinions on things. And that is something that I've always found difficult, because things change so quickly. You should always be asking for feedback.
That's exactly it. I mean, working on feedback is something that I continually have to strive for, because it doesn't necessarily come that naturally to me. I'm very happy to get something, you know, run off to a dark corner, get it to a point I think it's all right, and then ask for feedback. But I could have run off down a dark alley. So consciously having to drag myself back in. But it's realizing the people that you're working for don't want you to fail. They want you to get it right. So they're not going to give you feedback that's necessarily going to say, you know, oh, let's see where you head with this. It's going to be, okay, I like this, I don't like that, I like this, I don't like that. Let's think about that. Have you thought about, you know, really focus where you're heading, rather than push, you know, expect you to fail.
Last kind of thoughts, technology you know, I'm obviously a big nerd on technology.
Yeah.
You know, for you personally as well, I like asking this, but kind of what technologies are you most excited about, kind of that are on the verge of kind of coming into fruition? You know, what is it, you know, that's going to impact you directly or just in general do you think is going to be a cool bit of tech?
So some of the stuff that I was really interested in, so we used video interviewing in our last role, in my last role. And the straightforward pre-recorded video interviewing was pretty mundane. You know, everyone knows what it does. But we worked with a company that was looking at things like body language recognition, tonality recognition, and picking up thousands and thousands of data points through the videos to kind of give you some underlying information about how the candidate was performing. And that was something that I found really, really interesting. Something that can, on the face of things, you might get a bog standard response to a straightforward question or a video interview. And you can infer some things from the way the individual might come across, but to actually get some data out the back of it is a really interesting thing and could prove really useful for the right business.
I agree. I think data is the most fascinating time at the moment. There's no question. And I think it can be applied to HR as well, even though I do think that it's, you know, you follow data, but then, you know, you need to, it's a case-by-case basis as you said earlier. So,
well, the data's got to be right for the organization. You have to have something that is telling the right story for whatever's important for that business at that point in time. It's only, you know, everyone could build a dashboard that will give you, you know, headcount, turnover, churn rates, recruitment, time to hires, cost per hires, all that stuff. But it's all that's doing is telling a story of what's already happening. It's using data like that or historic data to be able to tell you what's likely to happen with your people. That's where it gets interesting.
And I agree. And I'm sure you guys are kind of utilizing that to the best of your advantage as well.
We try to. try to. It's not perfect, but I don't think anyone's got it perfect yet.
Well, I mean, final thoughts are obviously good luck on the new role, Phil.
Thank you.
You'll have to let me know how things go. It's very exciting. And finally, just big thanks for kind of joining me on the show. I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed the chat as well, mate. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.